Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Universal Basic Income, What Everyone Needs to Know, by Matt Zwolinski and Miranda Perry Fleischer. Narrated by Terence Kidd. Publisher's Note: This audiobook contains references to material present in the print and e-book editions of the book. Introduction. Imagine getting $500 from the government every month, deposited into your bank account. Once received, the money would be yours to do whatever you want with. You could buy groceries, pay for rent or childcare, save it, or blow it all in one big night out. How would a steady stream of income like that change your life? What if everybody in your society got it? How would it change our world? The idea you've just imagined has a name, or rather, it has several names. Some people call it a guaranteed income. Others call it a basic income. In this book, we'll adopt the most common label used today, a universal basic income, or UBI for short. As we'll see in this book, the UBI is an idea that's been around for a long time, at least since the 18th century. But there has never been more interest in the idea than there is today. In 2016, Switzerland became the first country ever to hold a nationwide referendum on the UBI. The measure was defeated by a large margin, but this event would turn out to be just the beginning of a global wave of interest in the UBI. The Swiss referendum was followed quickly by pilot programs in Finland, the Netherlands, Scotland, and Ontario. In the United States, a UBI was the central policy proposal of Andrew Yang's 2020 presidential campaign. Yang's campaign attracted a horde of passionate followers, the Yang Gang, as they were called, and sparked a nationwide conversation about the merits of a UBI. Today, many of those individuals have gone on to push for a UBI or other forms of cash transfers in different venues. Some are working with the organization Yang founded, Humanity Forward, to advocate a permanent extension of the fully refundable child tax credit, a kind of UBI for kids. Others are working with Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, an organization that is currently sponsoring more than 40 different pilot programs in cities across the United States, from Los Angeles, California to Providence, Rhode Island. So, if the idea of a UBI has been around for several centuries, why is there suddenly so much interest in it today? The current popularity of the UBI does not seem to be due to any single factor or issue, but there does seem to be a cluster of issues related to economic insecurity which, taken together, have convinced a lot of people that the time is right for a UBI. Increasing inequality and stubbornly resistant pockets of poverty are one set of issues that have captured many people's attention. Developed economies are growing wealthier, but that wealth seems to be becoming more and more concentrated in a smaller number of hands, while the economic well-being of workers and the unemployed stagnates, or in some cases, declines. Merely tinkering with existing welfare programs seems unlikely to make a significant difference. A UBI would constitute a radical shift in our approach to shrinking inequality and dramatically reducing poverty. We also live in a world where the future of work is radically uncertain. Advances in technology and artificial intelligence, AI, have led to machines doing work that only humans used to be able to do, and the trend is likely to continue at an accelerated pace. At a minimum, these technological developments will be highly disruptive, putting many people out of work and leaving them struggling to find alternative employment. At worst, there simply might not be any sources of alternative employment once AI gets smart enough. What does a welfare state look like in a world without work? A UBI represents one possible way forward. Finally, some people are simply fed up with the expense, paternalism, and complexity of existing welfare systems. Do we really need hundreds of different social welfare programs at the federal, state, and local level? Do we really need a welfare system built on the assumption that poor people can't be trusted to make their own decisions about what to buy? A UBI strikes many as a simpler, more efficient, and more respectful way of helping the poor than our current system. Of course, the UBI is not without its critics. In fact, One of the interesting features of the debate over the UBI is the polarization of opinion on the topic. There are a lot of books out there that are passionately in support of the UBI, and there are a lot of critics who argue that a UBI would be a moral and economic catastrophe. They argue that a UBI would be ridiculously expensive. People would stop working. People would blow the money on drugs, alcohol, and gambling. A UBI is the first step on a slippery slope toward communism, and so on. What's too often missing from this debate is serious analysis that recognizes both the advantages and the drawbacks of a UBI. That is precisely what we hope to provide you within this book. Both of us are on the record as supporting a UBI, all things considered. But neither of us is suffering from any illusions regarding the potential problems with the policy. Our goal in this book is not to convince you to become a supporter of the UBI or to oppose it. Rather, we want to provide you with the most accurate information possible about the arguments, evidence, insights, and weaknesses from both sides of the debate, so that you could make up your own mind about the issue in an intelligent way. As a political philosopher and an expert in the law and economics of taxation and welfare policy, we're in a unique position to guide you through both the big ideas of the UBI and the nuts and bolts of policy design. It's important to think about whether a UBI would be fair or equitable or compatible with respect for the dignity and worth of the individual. But it's also important to know how it would work. How much would it realistically cost? How would it be funded? How would it be administered? Would it vary based on wealth, regional cost of living differences, or family composition? Too often, detailed issues of policy design are neglected in discussions about the UBI. Our book takes these issues seriously and presents a range of possible approaches for designing a UBI that works. Our book is organized into 7 parts. Part 1 provides a brief overview of the UBI, what it is, where the idea came from, where it's been tried, and what the main arguments for and against it are. Part 2 dives right into questions of policy detail. How big would a UBI be? Who would be eligible? How would it be delivered? And more. Part 3 compares the UBI with alternative social welfare policies such as the Earned Income Tax Credit, EITC, the Negative Income Tax, NIT, and traditional welfare programs like food stamps, which are now administered through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. Part 4 discusses the results of various experiments with the UBI. Part 5 discusses potential advantages of a UBI, and Part 6 discusses some common objections. Finally, Part 7 explores the politics of a UBI, which groups support it, which oppose it, and what chance does it have of actually becoming policy. Throughout the book, we compare a UBI with a range of alternative social welfare programs. Most of those policies will be drawn from the United States, since that is the country with which both of us are most familiar. But many of the lessons that we draw from these comparisons, in-kind versus cash transfers, means-tested versus non-means-tested programs, generalize to other countries as well. We think these comparisons will help you gain a better understanding of the distinctive features of a UBI, even if you are unfamiliar with or not particularly interested in the U.S. welfare system. We wrote this book to serve as a resource for people who want to gain a better understanding of the UBI, and we've tried to make it as useful and as flexible a resource as possible. If you want, you could listen to the whole thing from beginning to end. But each chapter in this book is a self-contained answer to a specific question about the UBI. So, if you just want to know, say, how a UBI would affect people's willingness to work, feel free to skip right to chapter 49 and listen to that answer on its own. Sometimes, in answering a question, we'll refer to ideas or data that we discuss elsewhere in the book. When we do that, we've provided cross-references to make it easy for you to jump straight to the relevant parts of the book. Finally, if you ever encounter a technical term or abbreviation, what's SNAP again, with which you are not familiar, you can refer to the glossary found in the print and ebook versions of this book. So, after all that, let's start with a seemingly simple question. Just what is a UBI anyway? Part 1. The Basics. 1. What is a basic income? A lot of confusion about the concept of a UBI results from people talking about it as though it was a single, precisely defined policy proposal. We think it's more helpful to think of the UBI as a family of proposals. All versions of a UBI have three key elements in common. Beyond those common elements, however, the differences between various proposals can be enormous, so much so that asking whether someone supports a UBI is almost a meaningless question. The real question is, what kind of UBI, if any, do you support? The first thing all UBI proposals have in common is that they involve unrestricted cash transfers. Most other government programs provide what are called in-kind benefits, free or discounted access to various types of goods and services. Medicaid provides the poor with access to medical care and prescription drugs. SNAP provides access to food. Government programs that do provide cash often restrict where it can be spent. A UBI, in contrast, gives people cash that they could use in any way they see fit. Second, the cash transfers that a UBI provides are unconditional in nature. What this means is that recipients' eligibility to receive the money is not dependent on whether they're working or not, whether they're trying to find work, or why they can't work. This, as we'll see, is one of the most sharply distinguishing features of a UBI compared with alternative social welfare policies. It is also one of the most controversial. Finally, the UBI is often said to be universal, in the sense that everybody gets it, rich and poor alike. In fact, this is often taken to be the central defining feature of a UBI. Universality is, after all, the U in UBI. On closer inspection, however, universality turns out to be a somewhat tricky concept to pin down. No UBI proposal that we have seen actually recommends giving the money to everyone. National UBI proposals, for instance, limit eligibility to citizens, or at least to permanent residents. Many proposals limit the UBI to adults, excluding children. And while most proponents of a UBI say that eligibility for the grant is not dependent on income or wealth, we'll let you in on a little secret. Nobody really means this. Here's why. A UBI that gave money to everybody would either be so expensive as to be unmanageable or so small as to be practically useless to the people who need it most. In order to provide a reasonably sized grant to the people who need it most, you simply have to use some sort of means testing. To use a means test is to limit benefits to individuals or households under a certain income threshold. Some proposals do this on the front end, only issuing checks to people whose income falls below a certain threshold. That's how a negative income tax, NIT, works. Refer to Chapter 29. But if you don't mean test on the front end, you need to do it on the back end. In other words, you give everybody a check, but then you tax some or all of the benefit back from people whose income exceeds a certain level. Such a program is still universal in a sense, but also, sort of, not really. Beyond these three very broad features, there is a lot of variation among UBI proposals. And, as they say, the devil is in the details. Whether a UBI would be a good idea or not probably depends a lot more on how these details are fleshed out than on the broad characteristics that all UBIs share. For instance, one important question is how large the UBI will be. Before, we used an example of a UBI of $500 per month. As we'll see, this is a pretty common proposal. But some people have proposed much larger UBIs, and some people have proposed smaller ones. How large a UBI ought to be will depend in part on what you think a UBI is for. Is the purpose of a UBI to supplement the income of people working in low-wage jobs? Is it to provide a steady stream of income for the temporarily unemployed? Or is the goal of a UBI to provide a permanent income, a way for people to meet their basic needs without ever having to work another day in their life? A relatively modest UBI might be sufficient to meet the first two goals, but the third would require a significantly more generous grant. A closely related issue involves how we would go about paying for a UBI. Giving $500 per month to every one of the 330 million or so people currently living in the United States would cost $165 billion per year a significant amount of money. Should we pay for it by taxing personal income, taxing corporations, cutting other programs? Obviously, the larger the UBI, the more pressing and difficult this question becomes. There is also the question of who is eligible to receive the UBI. Most proposals view the UBI as an individual entitlement. That is, they envision the UBI being paid to each individual person and not to families or households. But should a UBI be given to children or only to adults? Should it be given to anybody living in the country or only citizens or permanent residents? Should felons receive it? Should there be an income cutoff? We'll explore all of these questions in the rest of this book. For now, though, we can understand the UBI as a family of loosely related policies, all of which involve direct, unconditional, and sort of universal cash transfers. So, you might be asking, where did this idea come from? 2. Who first thought of the idea? We're glad you asked. The idea of a UBI has been around for a surprisingly long time. In fact, one of the first people to propose a basic income was one of the founding fathers of the United States. In 1796, Thomas Paine published a pamphlet titled Agrarian Justice, in which he proposed to create a national fund, out of which there shall be paid to every person when arrived at the age of 21 years the sum of £15 sterling, and also the sum of £10 per annum during life to every person now living of the age of 50 years, and to all others as they shall arrive at that age. Paine thought of these payments not as a form of charity or welfare, but as a kind of compensation to which individuals were entitled as a matter of right. What exactly was he trying to compensate people for? Well, Paine believed that the land, in its natural, uncultivated state, was the common property of the human race. In other words, each of us has a natural human right to the free use of the earth. Over time, however, much of the earth's land has been converted into private property. That has been great in terms of incentivizing people to put the land to productive use. And Paine thought that individuals are completely entitled to keep whatever they produce with their own labor. But the land itself isn't the product of anybody's labor. And so if humanity is going to let private individuals keep that land for their own personal use, those individuals owe humanity fair compensation for that privilege. Refer to Chapter 63 for further discussion of this argument. A similar argument would later be made by Henry George, whose 1879 bestseller, Progress and Poverty, would argue that this compensation could fund a single tax sufficient to fund all the legitimate activities of government. And, more recently, Peter Barnes has expanded Paine's idea by arguing humanity should be paid dividends based not merely on the value of land, but also the atmosphere and even the infrastructure of our financial system. Almost immediately after it was published, however, Paine's proposal was subjected to vigorous criticism. In a 1797 pamphlet titled The Rights of Infants, an English schoolteacher named Thomas Spence argued that while Paine's proposal was based on a great fundamental truth, it would nevertheless leave multitudes of the people poor and beggarly. Spence identified two specific problems with Paine's idea. First, the only people who qualified for a regular income under it were the elderly. Children received nothing, and adults received only a one-time payment that might quickly be used up. Second, Spence thought the level of the income was too small to eradicate poverty. To correct these problems, Spence proposed that the value of all land and houses be divided evenly among the community. The value to be distributed would include not only the unimproved value of natural resources, but the value of all improvements as well. And the beneficiaries of this distribution would include not merely the elderly, but everyone, whether male or female, married or single, legitimate or illegitimate, from a day old to the extremest age, making no difference between the families of rich farmers and merchants. Spence's proposal was thus more universal than Paine's and established more of a regular income for its beneficiaries. In both of these ways, Spence's model more closely resembles the modern idea of a UBI. The idea of a UBI would resurface again and again over the course of the 20th century. In England, The philosopher Bertrand Russell endorsed the idea in his 1918 book, Roads to Freedom, and the economist James Mead advocated what he called a social dividend in his 1989 Agathatopia, The Economics of Partnership. In the United States, a UBI found support from an ideologically diverse range of economists, including John Kenneth Galbraith, James Tobin, Milton Friedman, and Friedrich Hayek, many of whom championed a variation of a UBI called a negative income tax. Influenced by these scholars, President Richard Nixon championed something akin to a UBI in 1969, although ultimately his proposal was defeated in Congress. We'll have more to say about Nixon's family assistance plan in Chapter 64. In his last book, Where Do We Go From Here?, published in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote that, "I am now convinced that the simplest approach will prove to be the most effective. The solution to poverty is to abolish it directly by a now widely discussed measure, the guaranteed income. The dignity of the individual will flourish when the decisions concerning his life are in his own hands, when he has the assurance that his income is stable and certain, and when he knows that he has the means to seek self-improvement." From civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. to libertarian economist Milton Friedman to founding father Thomas Paine, we can see that the idea of a UBI has always attracted an ideologically diverse group of supporters. But what about today? 3. Who are some recent supporters of a basic income? So, the idea of a UBI has been around for a long, long time. But over the course of the last decade or so, interest in the UBI has simply exploded. The first signs of that explosion occurred in Switzerland in 2016. In that year, the country held a national referendum on the UBI, and for a while it looked like there was a decent chance that Switzerland would be the first country to adopt a permanent national UBI. Ultimately, voters rejected the measure by an overwhelming ratio of 3-1. But that may have had less to do with opposition to a UBI as such than with perceived flaws in the particular proposal under consideration. Some of the referendum supporters suggested that the UBI should be set at a level equivalent to roughly U.S. $2,500 per month per adult. With an estimated price tag of over 200 billion francs annually, this would cost more than three times the entire federal budget of Switzerland, an amount equal to almost one-third of the Swiss GDP. In the United States, the person most responsible for stimulating recent popular interest in the UBI is Andrew Yang. In 2020, Yang made a surprisingly successful run in the Democratic presidential primaries, based largely on his signature policy of a UBI of $1,000 per month for every American over the age of 18. Although ultimately unsuccessful, Yang's campaign attracted a wide and passionate group of followers, the Yang Gang, and transformed what had previously been a somewhat obscure idea into part of the mainstream political conversation. Yang's followers illustrate one of the most fascinating aspects of the UBI movement, the passionate, wholehearted intensity that grips many of the idea supporters. Longtime UBI advocate Scott Santons, for example, is so committed to UBI that he champions it as a full-time job. He is now one of its most vocal advocates on Twitter and elsewhere. And how does he support himself financially? He crowdsourced himself his own UBI, of course. Although Yang's candidacy catapulted UBI into the national spotlight, the idea had already been gaining steam across the political spectrum throughout the 21st century. Before Yang championed a UBI as the solution to widespread technological unemployment, labor leader Andy Stern made the same point in his 2016 book, Raising the Floor. A former president of the Service Employees International Union, Stern feared that continuing advances in artificial intelligence would lead to a future in which many ordinary people are unable to get good, dependable jobs. A UBI, he speculated, might not just be an option, but a necessity in a future without work. Meanwhile, on the right, American Enterprise Institute scholar Charles Murray advocated a UBI as a more efficient and humane replacement for what he saw as an expensive, convoluted, and paternalistic welfare state in his 2006 book, In Our Hands. Behind the scenes, a handful of scholars have been writing for decades about the advantages of a UBI. The Belgian philosopher, Philippe Van Parijs, has been called the godfather of the UBI movement and has been writing about the UBI since at least the late 1980s. His 2017 book, Basic Income, A Radical Proposal for a Free Society and a Sane Economy, is perhaps the most thorough and detailed scholarly defense of the proposal available. Another philosopher, Carl Weiderquist, has written voluminously on almost every aspect of the UBI debate, as well as serving as one of the founding editors of the academic journal Basic Income Studies. Guy Standing, Anne Lowry, Evelyn Forget, and Rutger Bregman have also written numerous books and articles on the UBI. Today, those academic ideas are catching on not just nationally, but globally. But has anyone actually implemented a UBI yet? 4. So, has a basic income ever been tried? Well, sort of. At the time of this writing, one U.S. state, one country, and one Native American tribe have something close to a UBI. Although these cases are each unusual in their own way, they, along with a number of other cash transfer programs and small-scale experiments, can help us better understand how a large-scale, permanent UBI might work. First, the U.S. state. Since 1982, Alaska has issued annual cash payments to every resident under a program called the Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend. This program has been incredibly popular with residents and does not appear to have produced any of the negative effects generally associated with the UBI by critics. We'll tell you more about that program in Chapter 32. Next, the country. And this one might surprise you. The only country in the world to have adopted a UBI is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's the backstory. In 2010, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made heavy cuts to government subsidies for bread and gas. To compensate, the government adopted a program of direct cash transfers, amounting to approximately 29% of median household income, or about $1.50 extra per person per day. Originally, these subsidies were to be made only to poor Iranian citizens, but technical difficulties in estimating income and dissatisfaction from those who would be excluded eventually led the government to opt for a universal benefit instead. The first payments under the program were issued in 2011, and they continue to this day, albeit at lower amounts. The program has received intense criticism from businesses and others who believe it disincentivizes work. But a 2018 study by economists found this criticism unjustified, concluding that the program did not affect labor supply in any appreciable way. Finally, back in the United States, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians has had something very much like a UBI since 1996. In that year, the tribe opened a casino and decided to distribute a portion of the revenues to all adult tribal members on an equalized per capita basis. Payments are made every 6 months, with an average annual value of approximately $4,000, making it by far the most generous of the three programs we've discussed here. And the results of these payments seem generally positive. One study found that these payments to be associated with an extra year of educational attainment by age 21, as well as a reduction in crime rates. We can also learn about how a UBI might work from looking at programs that involve other cash transfers, even if those transfers aren't fully unconditional or universal. For example, the Oportunidades program in Mexico and the Bolsa Familia program in Brazil have provided cash assistance to families for decades. In both cases, however, the assistance is conditional and less than fully universal. The programs target families with children, and parents will only receive the money if their children regularly attend school and receive certain forms of preventative health care. In addition to these long-standing programs, governments around the world have occasionally run shorter-term experiments with various kinds of cash transfers. The most famous set of experiments ran for over a decade in the United States between 1968 and 1982. These experiments were designed to test the idea of a negative income tax at a time when the Nixon administration was seriously considering implementing the idea. Ultimately, the plan was abandoned. We'll explain how a negative income tax compares to a UBI in Chapter 29 and we'll have much more to say about these experiments in Chapter 3.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?